Gildan Media presents Your Coach in a Box, affordable, life-changing audio programs. Gildan Audio presents an unabridged recording of Good for the Money, My Fight to Pay Back America by Bob Ben-Moshe, with Peter Marks and Valerie Hendy. The following dedication appears in the book. For my grandchildren. Forward. I first met Bob Ben-Moshe in the summer of 2009. It was almost 9 months after the government had bailed out AIG. The company was spiraling, battered in the press, condemned by Congress, beset by low morale, with customers and employees looking for the exits. The previous CEO had resigned that May, and Bob had been chosen to take over. I was leading our AIG efforts in the New York Fed at that time, and Tom Baxter, FRBNY General Counsel, and I were asked to meet with him before he took over. While I'd been warned that Bob was not your average CEO, it went far beyond that. The Bob I met on that day was unique, at least in my experience, in a number of ways. I'd never met anyone more direct. He didn't mince words in expressing his views on what had occurred to date and where he thought mistakes were made, and he gave assurances that his version of bull in a china shop would break some glass. I'd never met anyone with more energy. He spoke with his whole body and used nearly his entire range of voice that day to make sure we got a clear picture of his vision. And I'd never met anyone with less of a filter. I learned more about Bob's personal life in the short walk out of the building that day than I knew about many of my close friends. My first reaction to the new CEO? Holy crap, what are we getting ourselves into? But as Bob began to talk about the company, I realized that this man was just what AIG needed. Someone who would come in and shake things up. Get people within the company out of their, woe is me, I'm AIG mentality. Bob had a vision for what the company could be, but was also someone who wasn't afraid to meet head-on the public outcry and congressional uproar at the time. And right away, Bob did that. He may not have done it in the most tactful way, and that wouldn't be the first time, but he made it clear that he was fighting for the future of the company, its employees, its customers, and ultimately, full repayment to the government. Bob took over at a time when all of us were facing unprecedented situations. There was no playbook for how to resolve a trillion-dollar financial company. People expected a quick sale and a quick government exit, but this was impossible. There was great pressure to do it all fast, but that simply wouldn't work. It would require a strategic plan and time to execute. This is where Bob earned his salary again and again, by holding the company and the government to his plan. He would threaten to quit on more than one occasion when he felt he lacked support. Indeed, on day one, when compensation was being debated, he almost quit several times. I was sitting there with some board members during the back and forth, and again he came back to the importance of sticking up for a principle. He was trying to make a point, but he was deadly serious, and that gave him credibility. People took him seriously. We're lucky that Bob was able to tell his story before he passed away. On one level, it offers all of us, corporate leaders, government regulators, politicians, a clear vision of what to do and, as importantly, what not to do during times of economic panic. Among the lessons that emerged? Governance really matters when it comes to big companies. Clearly, AIG had significant failings in this regard before the crisis, and Bob knew how to fix it and did fix it. The company operates much differently today than it did before the crisis. Leadership makes a difference. Bob embodied great leadership skills. He was a master at communicating with his employees on an emotional level and breaking down complex ideas into simple principles. Great leaders inspire with great stories, and Bob always had a story. Among my favorites, Mama's on the Roof, which starts with a man's finding out about his beloved cat's tragic fall from the roof from his brother, who shares the news in a sudden and blunt way. The man castigates his brother for his unfeeling bluntness and suggests, that news of this kind should be delivered in stages, to cushion the blow. He then asks his brother how their mother is, and the brother, adjusting his manner as instructed, responds that she is on the roof. Bob shared this story many times, as a way of making the point that all news, good or bad, should be shared as soon as it's known, and not held back to avoid a bad reaction. He also liked to tell the story of Sandy Koufax, who decided not to pitch Game 1 of the 1965 World Series because it fell on Yom Kippur. Koufax stuck to his principles, and for Bob, his story was about standing up for what you believe in. Great leaders also help people understand where they're coming from by explaining things in a clear and transparent way, and they are able to connect with people at all levels of the company. Bob knew people's names, what they did, and he continually thanked them. Bob had all of these traits. And finally, transparency and trust are critical. Bob believed in transparency, whether it was with the government, with his employees, or with the public. And it was that level of transparency that built the trust and the working partnership that was necessary for Bob's plan to work. You are about to listen to one of the great comeback stories in business history. Its importance isn't yet fully appreciated. When AIG paid back its government loans with interest in December 2012, it was more than just a company meeting its obligations. It was a once great company getting a new start. It was one of the great symbols of failure in the crisis coming back to life. And practically speaking, a world in which AIG actually failed and had to be wound down completely would have been catastrophic. And AIG would not have been the only damage in that scenario. AIG's connections to business, big and small, here and abroad, to retirees and savers, and to millions of insured Americans, meant that AIG's failure would have damaged more than just AIG. Politics did not allow people in the government to thank Bob publicly for his service, something that he often mentioned. I'm confident, though, that everyone involved with the turnaround at AIG acknowledged privately the incredible service he performed for AIG and for the country. I was no longer involved with AIG when I heard that Bob had cancer. The last time I got to see him one-on-one was in the summer of 2014, when we got together for lunch. I wanted to get some advice from Bob on how to think about my career and next steps. Bob was, as he always was, supportive and challenging. He was always looking for the next challenge for leaders he wanted to develop. It was a low point for him. His mind was as sharp and energetic as ever, but his body was failing. He couldn't eat or walk up the stairs. I saw him again at his retirement party a few months after that, and witnessed a final Ben Moshe performance. Person after person got up to say nice things about Bob, and then it was his turn. Without acknowledging all of the accolades, he immediately launched into a pep talk. You all have to give your support to incoming CEO Peter Hancock. You have to keep making things happen, he said. He was motivational, inspirational, sometimes hectoring. I don't want to hear any more of your shit. That was classic Bob. Supportive, leading. And that was the last time I saw him. Sarah J. Dahlgren. Chapter 1. The good news is, you're not paranoid. The truth was, I didn't need the job. I was content in retirement, living in the house of my dreams on Croatia's Adriatic coast, puttering around in my flip-flops, tending to the little side business we'd started, growing grapes for our own wine. But stepping back into the arena appealed to my sense of patriotic duty. Becoming CEO of American International Group, known by its universally reviled initials, AIG, would be an important service to the country. AIG had almost taken down the entire global economy as a result of the role of one of its divisions, AIG Financial Products, in the calamitous subprime mortgage market. Now, it was reeling under the weight of the astronomical $182 billion in bailout funds it owed the taxpayers. The company was in such disarray that it had burned through 4 CEOs in 4 years. Last one hounded out after a humiliating dressing down by Congress. I would be CEO number 5 in that line. Lucky me. Sure, I knew that wading into this situation would be messy. I just hadn't fully calculated the magnitude of the mess. In fact, on Monday, August 3rd, 2009, my very first day in AIG's offices in Manhattan's financial district, the groundwork was being laid for an attempt at neutering my leadership. I would soon find that a powerful faction within the company was opposed to the direction in which I planned to take it. Hanging in the balance was the fate of what was then the world's largest insurance company, a firm with $1 trillion in assets and dealings in 130 nations. Well, as the saying goes, no good deed goes unpunished. I didn't want to start the job until October, but officials at the U.S. Treasury Department, now owners of 79.9% of the company's stock, had other ideas. October? Impossible. The new CEO had to start when the man he was replacing, Edward Liddy, departed on August 10th. So I agreed to their timetable. I arranged to start at AIG on August 3rd, a week before Liddy's departure, on an unofficial basis. That way I would spend some time in the first half of August getting to know employees in the various units of AIG around the United States, take the end of August to honor my commitments in Croatia, where I had retired to start a vineyard, and then return full-time to AIG on September 8th. Not everyone was thrilled, me included. I still didn't even have a salary and compensation package nailed down. But I made it clear I wasn't going to alter this plan. Little did I know my vacation in Croatia, which had the blessing of the government officials who urged me to take the job, would soon be fodder for an attack by my enemies on the board and elsewhere. Within days, news of the trip would be leaked to the media as evidence of more AIG profligacy. Of the sense that the company, already on the defensive over its desire to pay contractually mandated executive bonuses, just didn't get it. Oh, I got it, all right. It was the first salvo in a campaign from within the company to try to smother my leadership in its infancy and scuttle the plan I was formulating. My goal was simple: for AIG to defy the odds and pay back America in full. I knew that AIG was still a tremendously valuable company that had been dragged down by a couple of divisions that made really bad bets on mortgage-backed derivatives. These toxic contracts had become, in Warren Buffett's colorful phraseology, the financial world's weapons of mass destruction. By no means, though, did they reflect on the worth of the rest of the company. I intended to clean up the derivatives mess so that AIG could reestablish itself as one of the world's premier insurance companies, and a mighty profitable one at that. My ideas ran counter to those of some in the upper echelons of the firm. This faction wanted to unload huge portions of the company as fast as possible at what I knew would be ridiculous fire sale prices. They had the backing of the Wall Street bankers who had made a fortune, $100 million at least, and consulting fees working for AIG, and who were poised to make a lot more through commissions in the rapid sell-offs. Adding to the absurdity was that these were the very Wall Street vultures who had sold AIG the toxic derivatives to begin with. I have spent a veritable lifetime in the financial industry, so when I saw that the buzzards were circling, ready to swoop in on AIG's highly prized insurance entities and real estate holdings, I know of what species I speak. Not even the U.S. government seemed averse to selling AIG units at bargain prices. The prevailing philosophy in Washington was, let's recoup whatever we can as fast as we can. No less a figure than Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, one of the architects of the bailout, first as head of the New York Fed and then as a member of President Obama's cabinet, privately expressed his strong doubts over AIG ever paying back its debt. My feeling was quite different. I believed AIG could pay the government back. I wouldn't have taken the job if I didn't. I also figured out quickly that those at AIG who didn't share that belief wanted me silenced, discredited, and shunted aside. Which reminds me of an old joke. A guy goes to his psychiatrist and the doctor tells him, I've got good news and bad news for you. The good news is, you're not paranoid. The bad news is, they're out to get you. I hadn't pinpointed who specifically was out to get me, but by the time the story leaked in Bloomberg News the following week, with the headline, Ben Moshe said to start AIG tenure with Croatian trip, I'd begun to get an inkling. Over the next 5 years, I would do battle on many fronts in my fight to make the American taxpayer whole after AIG's errors during the subprime debacle. Well before my tenure as CEO ended in September 2014, I'd made good on my vow. AIG had not only paid the country back, but also had settled the account with a $22.7 billion profit. But there were bitter battles along the way. One pitted me against AIG's own board of directors, an entity that normally would have been expected to support management's plans. They were led by their formidable, newly installed chairman, Harvey Golub, a former CEO of American Express Company, with whom I would lock horns over how to run AIG. I also had adversaries outside of AIG, namely some craven politicians who were making our jobs harder by publicly slinging mud at us and in the process putting the lives of AIG employees at risk. A battle, too, had to be waged in the public relations arena, with some influential media types who thought us an easy target and found allies within the company who leaked inside information to them, further sowing anxieties about me and the company. As tough as these struggles were, they didn't faze me. It wasn't even the worst corporate backstabbing I had experienced. That distinction went to my time in the 1980s and early 90s at the brokerage firm Payne Webber, where I was well-schooled in Wall Street's cage-fight mentality. Even there, my foes had nothing on the cruelest and most intractable enemy I've ever had to face, the cancer with which I was diagnosed in October 2010, a year and 2 months after I got to AIG. The disease was supposed to end my life quickly. It didn't, thanks to some amazing medicine. But it's an adversary I continue to fight with every ounce of strength in my 6-foot-4-inch body. From those very first days at AIG, however, I was still prepping for the fight, even if I was still only starting to get my bearings. First, though, I had to begin to deal with another insidious problem. Morale throughout the company was dangerously low. The daily onslaught of bad news and negative commentary had taken its toll on a workforce that felt little compunction about staying. They weren't even sure if AIG would continue to exist. So I made it my first order of business to reach out directly to the employees, to let them know that the new sheriff in town was on their side. On my second morning, Tuesday, August 4th, 2009, I called a town hall meeting at AIG's corporate headquarters at 70 Pine Street to lay out my philosophy, to say some things that AIG's workers had not been hearing from their leader, maybe ever. The fact is, I said, warming to the room packed with hundreds, you are AIG, and it's time we stop being embarrassed by it. And it's time that the people in Congress stop talking about you as the problem, because you're the solution. The attacks on AIG had gone beyond angry rhetoric to outright threats. The children of some workers in Connecticut were beaten up at school, and some employees were being harassed online and confronted in person. I needed them to hear me loud and clear on the issue that is, let's face it, foremost in the mind of every worker, everywhere. I just wanted to assure all of you that my first priority is getting your compensation right, making sure that from myself on down, all get paid competitively, so that you can come here every day and get fairly paid for what it is that you're doing, I said. I also referred to the divestiture plan that had been worked out by departing CEO Liddy and his restructuring expert, Paula Reynolds, a plan I had absolutely no intention of following. I did not say that outright, as Liddy was standing there and I had no details to present. I did offer a preview of my thoughts, though. I am not a liquidator, I said. I don't liquidate things. I build them. The relief in the room was palpable, especially as I sought to calm the audience's apparent nerves with some off-the-cuff humor. In the first minute of my first address before an AIG audience, I got a laugh when I explained, "I am not your dentist, and I am not going to ask you to open wide, and we're not going to start drilling, so we ought to relax just a little bit here." It wouldn't be long before some of my words at that private gathering also made their way into the press. Bloomberg News quoted me, accurately, as having said that the government was creating lynch mobs. Not the most sensitive phrase I could come up with. The leaks bolstered my belief that a campaign was being mounted to preempt me by people with intimate knowledge of the company and the workings of the media. That those leaks may actually have served my purpose by making me seem like someone politicians didn't want to mess with was beside the point. The unauthorized disclosures were confirmation I was at the helm of a porous organization, some of whose more than 100,000 employees harbored hopes of my undoing. As the doctor said, the good news is you're not paranoid. The task that lay before me amounted to one of the most challenging of my career, a working life that had been tested before by high-stakes pressure and internal strife. Still, I could tell that this job was going to be a new kind of challenge, one that would call on every aspect of what I've learned about leadership. Over the course of telling this story, I'm going to impart as many of those leadership lessons as I can. They are not, though, lessons of the business school variety. I've never been to one. Never, in fact, enrolled in a single business class, ever. These are ideas gleaned from a life in business, with an emphasis as much on the life part as the business. You'll discover in these pages, too, that I'm a full-fledged believer in the amazing things this nation can do when you give people freedom to act. If they choose to act responsibly, and most people in this country do, it's incredible what can be achieved. My desire to join AIG at this juncture was tied up in this idea, in a faith in the talent of the workforce, and in convincing them that they had the freedom to act. I wanted to draw on their initiative to help propel us forward. From the outset, I was convinced we could accomplish what would seem incredible things, in spite of the tough conditions, in spite of a corrosively negative environment. I think, too, that I had given myself a larger purpose, to make the renewal of AIG an example of American resilience, to provide evidence to the world that America was still strong, that we were still a capable people. The company's return to health would reaffirm that. It would say that our identity as a can-do culture remained valid, that both collectively and individually, we could still make a difference. Now, you may be wondering why a guy who had been contentedly trudging around in shorts on a terrace on the Adriatic Sea would want to parachute into this particular minefield. The insurance business isn't the sexiest in the marketplace, but this insurance company had managed to land in the middle of the world's hottest financial story. And not for good reasons. The once widely admired firm was now perceived as so dysfunctional that when writing about it in his memoir, Henry Paulson, President George W. Bush's Treasury Secretary, declared, AIG's incompetence was stunning. Looking back at the magnitude of the mess I agreed to take on, I do at times think I might have spent too much time in the midday Croatian sun, because AIG at that moment looked to much of the world like a corporate ghost ship navigating toward its doom. Providing financial security for millions of policyholders was the company's bedrock mission, but it was not at this point what it was best known for. As a result of the miscalculations before I was on the scene, and egged on by some political demonizing, AIG was now one of, if not the most, despised companies on the planet. Facing mounting obligations it couldn't meet as a result of its bad bets on the mortgage markets, and deemed by federal regulators too integral to the nation's financial health to be allowed to slide into bankruptcy, the company had received a massive and massively unpopular government bailout. To keep AIG going, the Federal Reserve loaned the company billions, and the Department of the Treasury pumped in billions more throughout 2008, courtesy of a new vehicle created by Congress, the controversial Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, as it came to be known. Those loans, purchases of AIG assets and other instruments amounted to an almost unfathomable figure, $182.3 billion. It was by far the most money any publicly held company received, more than Citigroup, Bank of America, or any other among the better-known corporations that contributed to the disaster. No wonder average Americans, many of them living in houses newly underwater or terrified about losing their jobs in a tanking economy, had dark thoughts when AIG was mentioned. Those initials, in fact, were all many people knew about the firm. It seemed to a lot of them that this New York-based headquartered company, with a not very clear identity, AIG, after all, was the name of a nebulous parent holding company for dozens of other insurance and financial entities, was being propped up just as their own household security was crumbling. I was angry myself, and not simply because, as I watched the crisis unfold, I developed serious misgivings about the way the government was treating the company. In a long business career, capped by my retirement in 2006 as CEO of another insurance giant, Metropolitan Life Insurance, or MetLife, I'd invested wisely and amassed some wealth. And that, too, was to some extent disappearing in the crisis. I, like millions of other Americans, had been a mere spectator to these events up to the time my phone rang in my home in Dubrovnik in the spring of 2009. A search committee led by AIG board member Dennis Damerman, who had worked alongside Jack Welch at General Electric, was looking for the fifth CEO since Hank Greenberg's 2005 departure. "Take it," was my son Ari's blunt reaction when I told him that feelers were being sent about my interest in running AIG. It was actually not the first time I'd been approached about the job. In September 2008, with the meltdown in its early stages, Christopher Cole, an emissary from Secretary Paulson, had asked me about it. At that chaotic moment, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was in freefall, losing 440 points on September 17th alone. The just-announced AIG bailout was not reassuring the markets. I knew Cole and Paulson from the days both worked at the investment house Goldman Sachs, although I didn't have fond memories of my prior contact with Paulson. I recall having dressed him down once when I was CEO of MetLife over the way Goldman was advising on a job for us. I had no intention, by the way, of becoming CEO of AIG if they offered me a dollar a year, as Liddy would later agree to. As I often said, I'm easy, but I'm not cheap. And as I always do with big decisions, I consulted my closest advisors, namely my family, my businessman son, my daughter Nihama, then finishing up her rabbinical studies, and my wife Denise, from whom I have been legally separated since 1999, but with whom I maintain a warm and close relationship. I also consulted my longtime companion, Lisa Weber, an executive whom I'd known since our days together at Payne Weber. "You're the right man for the job," they all declared, adding it would be good both for me and for them. I thought I was doing pretty well as a retiree, but in their estimation, I was restless and in need of something more stimulating than overseeing the bottling of my own Croatian red wine. Denise was very emphatic about this. Although we weren't together all the time, she could see, when we were, that I was growing bored. "You know you have to do something," she said. "You can't just sit here and look at the water." There was also the huge hit I was taking financially on the meltdown. My millions in MetLife stock options, the nest egg that allowed me to take a retirement at 62 in the first place, were losing value by the day. If AIG went down, I could envision the entire financial system going with it. But still, I wasn't entirely sold on the job, not if I wasn't going to be fairly compensated. Too much work. And anyway, in that go-around, Paulson tapped another Goldman Sachs alum, Liddy, who had been on the investment bank's board. I continued to watch the crisis unfold from the sidelines, though, and what I saw was frustrating to the point of being torturous. From an early age, I'd been a deep believer in a free market, as unfettered by government intervention as possible. Solid regulatory bodies were needed, certainly, but here was the government going beyond even a role as private industry safety net and insinuating itself into the fundamental mechanisms of the company. Regulators now had a say in AIG's executive hiring and pay. They said
Sample complete. Ready to continue?